Hey, it's movie retrospective time,
and
we're tripping balls this time.
Yeah, we're trying to figure out the lighting too. We're trying to figure out a good lighting arrangement. I don't know. Looks
yeah,
like this is all right.
It's
trying to get
workable.
Get soft bounce and try to control shadows and shit.
Yeah, this office isn't that big, so
no.
There's not really a lot of places you can put.
And I'm not a lighting specialist. I'm just pulling it out of my ass. Yeah, this movie's about tripping balls. Tripping balls and seeing Jesus.
Among other things.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys.
I grew up with this movie. I remember seeing it as a kid. It
yeah.
Scared the shit out of me. This guy's hallucinations.
It does have some very unsettling imagery. Yeah.
Yeah. But I look at it now. It's a good movie. It's kind of like the LSD version of Close Encounters in the Third Kind.
It is very tonally similar.
It feels kind of like Close Encounters.
Yeah.
If you like Close Encounters, Close Encounters is an awesome movie. It was like the first big budget sci-fi flick that I could remember as a kid was Close Encounters.
Yeah.
It's like Close Encounters, but tripping balls. It's about
like a midnight movie version of that.
Yeah, about a dude taking all these psychedelic drugs.
And getting into sensory deprivation.
He's a scientist, yeah. He's in a separate sensory deprivation tank. And he unlocks a certain part of his mind that is kind of like the poltergeist part of your mind where where your mind, your altered state of consciousness is now starting to manipulate matter. Namely, your own matter.
Yeah, it's almost kind of like, I mean, the basis of it is in scientific reality, but then they do kind of go off on some a little more fanciful things. But nothing so fanciful that it doesn't sound sort of plausible. You know what I mean? Like, he's pretty much operating on the premise that if you can access this kind of, I guess, like an atavistic part of your brain or like some kind of, you know, or tap into, I guess, like the, you know, universal consciousness maybe is what he's trying to do kind of. And you can sort of like go back through the eons and like see the entire evolution of the human race and the beginning of the universe and all
that.
Yeah,
this is not really science. Or science fiction, it's more kind of like philosophy.
It's a philosophical sci-fi movie,
There is a science-y setting in it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which kind of makes it a little bit more believable or more credible, even though some of the scientists are kind of like the voices of reason going, man, you're crazy, you can't do this, or you don't know what that drug's going to do to you, or... Come on, quantum physics and blah, 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 you know, fuck your quantum physics. That can't be. That guy's a great character.
He's probably my favorite character in the whole. His buddy, like the other, his colleague, I guess.
Yeah.
That's telling him to knock it off.
Yeah. The basic premise is there's this guy's a real scientist. He's fucking real good looking, you know. He's got away with the women and he's totally self-absorbed. He really only cares about himself. He marries this beautiful woman, but he just kind of neglects her. He didn't give a shit. He's going off with the Indians, fucking smoking peyote or doing whatever.
Taking ayahuasca
He's all into himself. You know, he's all up in his own ass and shit. You know, it's funny in a way, looking at it now. That part of the story went over my head as a kid.
Yeah. But I can see how it would.
But as an adult now, you kind of go, okay, I see what kind of guy they're talking about. And then he gets involved with all these visions and fucking, he gets mastery over his own body. And I guess in certain cases, the physical universe around him, because he's making vortexes and going off into other dimensions. People were trying to pull him out, remember?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like poltergeist phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, basically. I guess they're making the point that, like, he has tapped into some part of the brain that's pretty much, like, made this kind of philosophical, the interior of his mind is, like, kind of externalizing, aiming for.
Basically, he goes into a trance and goes through race memories, through his atoms, and becomes one with kind of like the Akashic records or the universal unconscious. And he can regress back into a damn caveman on a couple of... Basically, that's what happens. He turns into a caveman. He turns into a chaka.
It's a little chaka.
It kind of becomes a little bit like a werewolf story for a bit.
Yeah. It's funny because when we were watching it, like, I saw this... Altered States came out in 1980. And I probably saw it in the early to mid-1980s the first time. I remember liking it, but I think, like you said, I was fairly young, so I think, like, a lot of the really, like, heady, like, philosophical stuff sort of, like, I got the gist of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, you really, it's very dialogue heavy, you know, so you kind of have to listen to what they're talking about, like, to kind of get all the stuff and, like, all the symbolism and his visions and stuff. But, so I saw it once back then, I remember liking it, but then I didn't see it again for many years. And it's like when, you know, our main man, Rob, sent us a copy of it, which I was very excited about because I hadn't seen it in ages.
Right. It bring back good memories.
Yeah. And it seems like one that a lot of people don't really talk about all that much anymore, even though I think when I was growing up, like when I was in junior high or high school, like me and, you know, some of my friends that were kind of into like these weirder movies, you know, that was kind of a big one. It was like that and Videodrome. And it's like those were all the ones that we used to rent.
Yeah.
So, but I feel like it kind of... As good as it is, I feel like it's a little bit forgotten about nowadays. Yeah. Like, you don't really hear a lot of people talking about it anymore.
This wouldn't be a popular theme today because it goes against a lot of what people want to believe today. Like, the basic moral, basic premise of the story is that being an intellectual makes you an asshole and you don't care about other people and you'll get off into yourself and become very selfish. You turn into a damn monster or a caveman because you only care about yourself. But then... It kind of ends off with he shook that off and decided that searching for the meaning of life is kind of useless because life doesn't really have one meaning. The meaning of life changes a lot. It's transitory. So truth itself is transitory. There is not one truth. It's a truth that's always changing. And once you accept that, you realize that in life, the most important thing is love.
Yeah.
And living life, you know what I mean, with other people, you know.
Which...
So it's kind of anti-intellectual in a way.
Yeah, I didn't get that much from it necessarily because, I mean, the thing about it, everyone was scientists. I don't think they were demonizing the scientists because his wife was a scientist as well.
But he was an extreme case.
I think it was more like, because I very much, like, the first time, like, when we were watching this again, I was like, wow, this is a lot like Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah.
And it's funny because Paddy Chayefsky, who wrote the screenplay, he initially, when he was thinking about doing this movie, he did a 3-page screen treatment, which was loosely based on Jekyll and Hyde. So that's kind of what, because you kind of have the thing where he's like dabbling with things he shouldn't understand. It's like, and it almost, it doesn't really split him in two, but it kind of makes him turn into like a wild man or like, you know, a wilder version of himself. And it gets to a point near the end where he can't control it anymore.
Right.
Because like at first he has to take the drug or he has to be in the sensory deprivation tank or both to access these hallucinations, to access, you know, these visions, these transformations. But then after a while it starts happening on its own and he can't really control it anymore.
It'll happen while he's outside the tank. Eventually he gets to a point where he's just a big blob, a mass of damn matter with a face in it. And you could see that the movie From Beyond is a direct homage to this.
I had forgotten how similar that was.
It didn't click until I saw it.
Yeah.
And then it clicked later on when he was trying to shake off the effects of this shit, where he's hitting one wall to the next wall, And remember, me and you started laughing.
We started singing
Take on Me. He said that video directly stole from
this. And then the funny thing, too, is like later on, like after we watched the movie, we watched
a couple other reviews.
Welcome to the Basement. Yeah. Like Welcome to the Basement had done this one. And that exact scene, they started singing Take on Me. And I'm like, hey, we did that too.
So it wasn't our imagination. It's like a frame to frame. The people who made the AHA video stole that scene, like frame shot, shot for shot.
Well, they homaged.
Homaged that fucker. Where Pretty Boy's trying to come out of the comic book to get that girl. And in a way, that's kind of what was happening to the main character.
Yeah.
He was trying to snap out of that altered state to get back to his girl.
Yeah.
Basically.
Because, here's the thing. Like, he probably should have listened to her to start with because she was the one that told him.
Don't fuck with it.
She's like, one, don't fuck with it. And two, it's like, why you keep, it's like the meaning in your life, it's right here. It's me. Yeah. It's the kids. It's your family. It's your friends.
He was rejecting all that.
And he was like rejecting all that. And he's like looking for something else, like something more.
Well, that's what I meant by anti-intellectual. He was so intellectual, he couldn't connect with other people. He was a dick.
He was,
He was a dick.
He was a little bit like, and I mean, the thing about it, it's like there's a really good like love story in the middle of this where, you know, this was William Hurt's first movie, which I think is kind of amazing because he's really good in this. So him and Blair Brown, who are both scientists, but they're coming at things from like a different, she's more like in an anthropology type of line where he works with like people with schizophrenia and he's like really kind of interested in sensory deprivation and different states of consciousness and things like that. So he's a little more out there than she is. She's very into like studying people and like people's cultures and things like that. So you can see how she's more grounded in the here and now and the today and stuff. And some of the, you know, discussions that they have early on is her kind of trying to appeal to him that, you know, why do you keep going off into these big, long, you know, things like to look for meaning like someplace else? Because there isn't any. You won't find anything. It's all the meaning is here. You make your own. Yeah. And he doesn't really want to hear that because he seems very... Him as a character, he's very uncomfortable with emotions. He's uncomfortable around other people. You know, even when him and Blair Brown's character, like when they first like hook up and everything like that, you can tell that, I mean, he loves her and he cares about her, but he can't really express it. He can't really express it in any way. And he's always kind of like distracted and stuff. And she loves him anyway, which in the end is what redeems him. Now, some people don't like the ending. They think, oh, it's like super cheesy. It's like, oh, love conquers all, blah, blah. But, I can see how that
could be cheesy.
But yeah, one, how else could you end it? And two, I think it worked really well in this, because that was kind of the whole theme of the movie.
It's also a movie of its time.
True.
When I saw it back when it was new as a kid, this was about, what, 1980, I think.
1980 this came out.
And I guess I was seeing it probably around 81, probably like on HBO.
Yeah.
And that's why, because I didn't see this in the theater. That ending, this is a movie of its time. That was a good movie in its time.
Yeah.
It was as good as Close Encounters of the Third Kind. People today might say, that kind of movie's not that great. It was back then.
Yeah.
I love Close Encounters. I can watch that forever. Even though the ending is not a big fucking, you know, explosion fest.
Yeah.
Like, that's what movies became later on. People came out of the alien craft and said, what's up? And got reunited. That was it. And then some people
left. And I
really
liked that ending.
Yeah, I thought that was a good ending.
I mean, you know, that's the thing about ending a movie. I feel like ending a movie is really hard. And I feel like a lot of filmmakers nowadays, but you know, back then as well, they're like, oh, we have to like have end with a big explosion. You know what I mean? It's like they have to have a big finish. It's like, and I guess that's the easiest thing to do.
Right.
But if you can pull it off, like doing kind of a smaller ending like this, which I wouldn't call this a smaller ending because like his wife does like fucking go into this fucking vortex and like pull him out and shit.
Not only was he, you know, master of his own matter, he was fucking pulling a hole in a damn space time continuum.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, in the room where he was doing his trance, the effects are really cool. The effects hold up in this movie.
They really do. They look really good.
And I just had it on widescreen DVD, and it still looked good. I bet you the Blu-ray looks even better on a good TV. But he's in a swirling vortex, and she actually goes through it. It looks like dry ice.
Yeah.
But it looks really good.
With lights and stuff. Yeah,
and she's
cool
trying
looking.
To pull him out of this interdimensional door that he had created in this damn drug-induced trance. Actually, it got to the point where he didn't need the drugs.
Yeah, it was just doing it just like spontaneously.
He learned how to do it without it.
But Well, that's what I mean. I think he couldn't control it anymore. Like, right. I don't think he meant for that to happen.
No.
And I think that the implication being that if she had not pulled him out of the vortex at the end, he wouldn't have been able to come back because he was going like way back through the fucking to the birth of the universe and shit like that. So he was like becoming pure energy or whatever the hell he was becoming. Yeah, so I don't think if he would have been able to come back if she hadn't reached in there and got him.
And he kind of he came from like a Christian background, or at least he was mystified by Christianity. So all these visions and hallucinations he would have under the effects of these drugs all look like something out of the Book of Revelations, and they're pretty badass. I remember them, having to do with the death of his father and his father rejecting God on the deathbed. And they did that weird, he's seeing his dad on his deathbed, and the fucking Shroud of Turin falls over his face, and his dad pulls it off, and it hits the ground. And what happened? It started caught on fire. And then he sees his dad with a damn... with a ram's head with seven eyes and seven horns crucified going off out into the with fire and flames, and eventually he sees hell. Some really cool effects.
And some
and
then
of the slaughtering the lamb over the book to open the fucking seven seals. Mm-hmm. And that was some bizarre shit too. But I remember it. The scenes are so effective, and they're so well done with the sound and everything that I remembered them since I was a kid. And evidently, the director dropped a lot of acid to see what hallucinations were like, so he could put a hallucination on film. And having partaken myself, yeah, that's about what
it's
they're
like. It's
pretty
accurate.
That's
yeah.
That's what a real heavy trip is like.
I can.
And evidently, he goes and takes ayahuasca. They don't call it ayahuasca, but I guess that's what he took with the Indians down.
When I looked up on some like different things about this movie, some of them said it was Amanita muscaria, which is like that poisonous mushroom.
Okay, yeah, because they were shown it as a mushroom.
That's what I think it
was. But the ritual and everything, and talking about tapping into a cosmic consciousness, it sounds kind of like Joe Rogan talking about ayahuasca.
Yeah, and that does seem to be, like, in that part of the world, it does seem
to
be, like,
talking
to
alien souls and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's, like, I really, really like, I mean, okay, so, as I said, this was actually written by Paddy Chayefsky, who, this was based on his only novel that he ever wrote. He's actually more famous as a screenwriter. He wrote some Oscar winners, Marty, Network, some other ones. So, he actually wrote this as a novel after he had had an idea to do something about, like, Jekyll and Hyde type of thing, but also, like, based in a scientific framework, like, with all the scientists as characters. So this movie, it's funny to me because I'm surprised it turned out as good as it turned out because, like with a lot of these movies, it had a very, very troubled production history.
Yeah, it could have been a real piece of shit.
Oh, boy. Yeah, so initially it had a different director. It had a lower budget. And then it's like, so Paddy Chayefsky, I guess he had a thing, because he was a very successful screenwriter, I guess he had a thing in his contract where you weren't really allowed to change his script, which he's maybe one of the few people back then that could get away with that shit. So him and the first director got into it, like when the movie was only less than halfway done. So eventually they brought in Ken Russell. Now, if anybody knows anything about Ken Russell, this was actually, I don't think this was the first Ken Russell movie that I saw. That might have been Lair of the White Worm or maybe The Devils, which are both very, very weird, and I would also recommend them. I also saw Women in Love. That was very good, too.
I forgot Lair of the White Worm. I saw it was weird, but I don't remember it.
That's a weird one. It's based on a Bram Stoker story, actually. Okay. But yeah, so the thing about it, though, is that they finally end up asking Ken Russell to direct it. It's like they were kind of, you know, under the gun. The budget had been going up. I think initially they got $9 million initially, and then in the end it ended up costing like $15 million. $4 million of that was for the special effects, which, like I said, are still actually very good. So Ken Russell was like, well, I think they asked me because I have like a really visual imagination and stuff. But it turns out, at least according to Ken Russell's agent, that he was actually the 27th director on the list. Like, yeah. And they were just going down asking, you know, like Steven Spielberg. They were asking, like, other directors they weren't doing. And I was like, no, thank you.
It's funny because this feels so much like an early Spielberg flick.
It does a bit.
It just does. I'm gonna save my comment to the end.
You are?
I'm going to save it to the end.
Are you gonna remember what it is?
Oh, I know exactly what it is.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to... where I placed this movie. I'm gonna talk about it.
All right. Okay. So the problem being, so Ken Russell comes on. At that point, it had pretty much like all been cast and stuff like that. So him and Paddy Chayefsky, then they kind of got into it. Because like I said, Paddy Chayefsky was very kind of thing. It was like, hey, please don't change my screenplay. And so what Ken Russell was trying to do, he's like, I'm trying to like translate these crazy visions that he has written down, and I'm trying to translate them into an interesting, you know, way. But it's like, you know, Patty's not really, they're not really seeing eye to eye on it, I guess. And he's like, and he wouldn't let me change any of his dialogue and all this other kind of stuff. So they kind of fought. And eventually, I think Paddy Chayefsky ended up taking his name off the movie and putting screenwriting like under some other name, like Sidney Aaron or something, which I think is actually his real name. So he didn't really want his name on it, although it still does say in the credits, because I noticed based on the novel by. But I don't think he has the screenwriting credit, although he did write the screenplay, but he was like upset about it. So this movie came out and it got kind of, you know, mixed to positive reviews. It made more than its budget back, but it didn't make as much as they were expecting. I think, like I said, the budget was about $15 million. I think it only ended up making a little bit less than $20 million. So not a great amount of money. But I think over the years, like at least in the 80s and into the early 90s, at least what I remember, because like I said, I was really into, you know, I had a group of friends that were into like all these kind of weird like midnight movies and stuff. So it seemed like one of the main ones that, you know, you got to see this one because it's like a fucking drug trip. You know
it was
what I
mean? A respected movie in its era.
It was, yeah.
It's kind of a forgotten classic. I'm going to say that. It's
yeah.
A forgotten classic.
Yeah, because I think the last time, like I said, the last time I heard people talking about it was maybe when I was in high school, like in the late 80s,
yeah.
Early 90s, maybe. And I feel like people were still talking about it then. Like I said, you talked about it in the same breath as like Videodrome or like 2001
yeah.
or something like that, that had that kind of like weird.
It was an epic movie.
Yeah, that weird kind of like, you know, thing to it. And it was, oh, you have to see this, like all the imagery is like super weird. And it's like, I was going to say too, that a lot of the footage of Hell, like the Inferno stuff, that was actually from a silent movie from the 1930s yeah, that was based on Dante's Inferno.
It did look like
yes, this. Yes, they used a little bit of that just.
Because it was in the public domain.
Yeah, because it's yeah. public. Domain so yeah. to give it that kind of like creepy,
but it was really updated. It looked creepy and it looked fucking real.
There is just like some great fucking visuals in this, man.
Yeah,
it's just like I mean the Ram from Revelation, that's my favorite.
Yeah,
but there's also that great scene where, you know, his wife is in the vision and she's like naked and she's like crawling on the ground and then like she turns into a lizard.
And then she turns into a sand.
Yeah. And then like they turn into sand and like yeah. the sand starts blowing away. Like it's almost like the eons are going by. And,
yeah.
Like,
it's real being... long, like you're tripping.
Yeah. And it's just like that. And it's just like right. this really, really cool, like right. creepy. And even like the regular scenes, because I do have to say this is a very... It's a very philosophical movie. It's a very dialogue heavy movie. And yeah. it's one that you kind of, if you want to know exactly what's going on, you do kind of have to listen to all the nuances of conversation and stuff. Because I have to say too, that shit happens like really fast. Like
it has action though too. It does have action.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like it's dialogue heavy in the boring way.
Yeah. No, yeah. I didn't yeah. mean it like that. Right. I just meant that this is one where you really have to listen to people's conversations.
I would put the movie. I'm going to wrap it up for what I'm going to say. I'm not going to say any more about the movie. But I put the movie on par right up there with Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Poltergeist 1.
Yeah.
I would say if you liked those two movies, you'd like this one. Yeah. It's good.
And like I said, it definitely has...
It's a lost classic.
It has a 2001 kind of vibe to it, too. Like, a lot of the imagery, like, gives me a little bit of that type of thing. Especially, like, when he's having the trip and he was go through, like, the universe and shit like that.
Almost Exorcist 1, too, in a weird way.
I've heard it compared to that as well.
Kind of like Exorcist.
Like, a little bit.
Right.
I mean, you have to think, like, the implications of it are... it's kind of a ballsy movie, like, because basically what it's saying is that there is no deeper meaning of life.
Yeah, it is as good as all those movies that I mentioned, but I think it's, like I said, for some reason it slipped through the cracks. I think it got overplayed on HBO and it got taken for granted and
maybe
kind of forgotten, because I remember it was on heavy rotation.
I saw it a bunch of times, just like when I was growing up.
I think they burned it out. I hadn't seen the movie in a long time. I hadn't seen it since I was a kid, and as an adult I appreciated the movie a lot more.
You know what's really funny?
It's a lot
like,
better.
I mean, when we watched it for this review, like, you know, yesterday or the day before, I hadn't seen it for many years, and I remembered the special effects not looking that good.
They look good.
But then when I watched it again, like, especially, yeah. I was like, you know, when he turns into the Chaka and, like, you know,
yeah.
with the optical work and stuff like that, which always looks a little bit weird from that time just because of the way they did it. But it's like, when I watched it again, I was like, holy crap, the special effects in this are really good and they really held up. Especially like his kind of Cronenbergian like transformation scenes, like where his arm and stuff is all bubbling out. I think Dick Smith might have worked on that.
The film to video transfer probably wasn't very good. And that's what we were seeing. We were seeing it on those old TVs.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was.
Yeah, it probably looked really good in the theater. And we didn't get that effect until we see it now on DVD or Blu-ray.
Yeah.
On a good HD TV. You know, then you could see how cool that movie looked.
Because the whole time I was like, because I remembered him going into the isolation tank and coming out being a Chaka or being, you know, an Australopithecus or whatever.
We were joking around calling him Chaka.
I call him Chaka.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I call any kind of little Australopithecus kind of creature. But it's like, I had remembered, I was waiting for that to happen. And I remembered, I was like, oh, that was so cheesy looking. I remember. But then when he came out, I'm like, oh, that's not cheesy looking at all. He does actually kind of look like it. You know, it wasn't William Hurt playing. It was another actor.
The only thing cheesy about the Chaka was that you could tell that the guy playing the chaka was some kind of a dancer or had dance training.
Well, he was clearly an acrobat, yeah, which is what they wanted, because they wanted somebody that could climb and like jump around like an ape would.
The way he's doing his head and everything, you know what I mean? You could tell he wasn't a wild animal. He's like a dancer.
At least he didn't do jazz hands.
Yeah, and
although how funny
he did a bunch of wee woo sounds and stuff when you would think it'd be like fucking primal screams or clicks or something. Something monkey-like.
Yeah, that's actually, it's funny that you point that out, because when William Hurt's character, whose name is Edward Jessup, by the way, when he was in the tank,
he said
that he was regressing, and he made a noise, and it sounded like a monkey noise, like an ape noise.
I wouldn't have had a man's voice coming out of that. I would have dubbed in a bunch of monkey noises, baboons and chimps and shit like that.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Yeah,
it would have been a lot more effective, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe like a baboon screaming.
That would have been alarming.
It'd have been a lot more alarming, I think. Now, the scenes with the chaka in it kind of reminded me a lot of American Werewolf in London.
Exactly what I was going to say. Because, he's like wakes up in the zoo. The funny thing, I was like, when we were watching the Welcome to the Basement thing about that, there's one scene in this where the chaka is like running around and he jumps over a wall and suddenly tapir. It's just like right there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I thought that was really funny. And they like cracked up and they were like, they need more lead up to that he was actually jumping into a zoo, because you weren't expecting him to just like be in the middle of Boston or wherever the fuck he was. And he just jumps over a wall and there's like a big fucking, I thought it was a rhino at first, but actually I think it was a tapir, because he didn't have like a horn. He just had that little, that little snooty thing like over his mouth.
But I think it's a good movie. I think it's a good movie. If you saw it as a kid and hadn't seen it in a long time, go ahead and rewatch it. You'll have a different take on it. If you've never seen it, I think it's a lost classic.
Yeah.
It's as good as Close Encounters, I'd say.
It's super trippy. And I said, it was actually based on some real research they were doing back in the 60s, like with ketamine and stuff like that.
Yeah, and they were good at building up tension of him messing around in that damn tank. And you're like, well, what the hell's going on? It is kind of eerie.
It has a really eerie tone to it. Yeah. Like a lot of Ken Russell's movies have that. Like he's really, really good at setting up these really like unsettling looking images and unsettling shots and stuff. One thing I was going to say earlier on was that one thing that is kind of strange about this, and maybe, I don't know, maybe it kind of like feeds into the whole like disconnection between him and his wife, which is kind of one of the main themes like at the center of the story, is that he basically meets her at a party, like very, very early in the movie. And then like, there's no card that says like 7 years later or anything like that. It's just suddenly the next scene, it's 7 years later. Like they've been married for 7 years. They have two kids all of a sudden. Yeah. It's like, you know, they're talking about getting divorced. And
time goes far.
And you're like, what? You know what I mean? So it's like, in a way, I guess.
He meets her and like a few minutes later, he's already divorcing her and they got kids. You're like, what the hell happened?
Yeah, well, it seems like they meet, and then they have sex, and then they have, like, you know, a couple, like, kind of in-depth conversations, and then they're like, oh, we should get married, and then the next scene is, like, they've been married for 7 years, and they have two kids. One of those kids is Drew Barrymore, by the way.
I didn't notice it.
She doesn't have any lines or anything. She's just, like, in the background. You can't really see her, but
maybe they edited it out.
Maybe. I haven't heard much about it. Here's the weird thing. It's, like, the DVD that we got that Rob sent us, I don't think there's any extras on there except for a couple of trailers and like just some text, like kind of telling you a little bit about the background of the movie.
Yeah.
But it's like, I heard that a Blu-ray release came out, but it doesn't have anything on it either.
Yeah.
So I feel like I don't know.
Maybe they didn't save anything.
I don't know if there's not any background footage or if nobody thinks like people don't care enough to like make.
It was a long time ago. They probably didn't keep anything. There's a lot of stuff that was lost.
I guess so. I mean, because nobody thought about it back then. Right. It's like, oh, you know,
one day there will be 40 years from now, there'll be
Blu-rays and everybody will want all this extra shit on it about what we're doing. It's like now they save everything. But it's like, it's kind of sad. I mean, I know that there was a book written about this, like about the making of it and stuff, but it doesn't seem like there's a documentary. I mean, this needs like a fucking Criterion collection or something like that, like with some interviews with the people and shit like that. I mean, I would really like that.
It'll probably come.
Because I would really like, and also I would really like a little bit about the real doctors and like their ketamine experiments and stuff like that, that this original screenplay was kind of based on. Because they said that the whole thing about the chaka and everything, they got that from like one real thing where they were doing like a ketamine experiment and they were working with the sensory deprivation tank. And one of the doctors that was doing the shit started jumping up and down and said he was a chimpanzee and that he was like on the savannah and like he was a proto-human and stuff like that. Yeah. So they got that like right right from their real research. Yeah. Drugs are bad, okay? Tripping ball. But yeah, seriously, this is a really good, if you're like into really weird like drug movies and like stuff with like really trippy visuals and stuff, I don't know if I'd call this a horror movie. It does have some kind of horror-y kind of elements. It's kind of sci-fi, but it's more, like I said, more on the philosophical, creepy, weird end of sci-fi. Like
a philosophical action movie.
Yeah, it's not like hard sci-fi or anything like that. It's kind of like hard to classify.
It's a paranormal movie.
It is kind of, yeah. It kind of falls into that weird gap of like sort of scientific and sort of not and stuff like that. But yeah, so if you've never seen Altered States, and if you're into Ken Russell, seriously, see some of his other shit because that dude's a fucking weirdo and he makes some really, really weird movies, but I kind of love them. And this is easily one of his best ones. So check it out if you haven't seen it.